Josh Blue here.
Can you tell me, you know, a bit of your background, kind of your story growing up? Where are you from originally?
I grew up in St. Paul. I was actually born in Cameroon, West Africa.
Oh, really?
And, so I think that really has influenced me as being a white African-American. because growing up, you know, that was a big part of my life, was like my parents talking about Africa. Our house is like a museum with all these wood carvings and masks and cloth from Africa. So I had a very big tie to Africa, even though I was some scrawny little white dude.
When did you move here? At what age?
I was really probably like one when we moved to Minnesota.
Okay.
So I don't have any physical recollection of Africa then, but when I was 15, we moved to Senegal for a whole year, and it was my sophomore year of high school. I was 15, and
Were either of those countries segregated in the same way that South Africa was?
No, it was very, they had already gone through their, you know, losing their colonial ties with France. They're both French-speaking countries. So,
okay.
But, you know, Senegal definitely had a lot of colonial, I mean, the buildings are all French style, and, you know, so I feel like, for me, like, as far as, like, pivotal points in my life, like, going to Senegal when I was 15 was such a eye-opening experience.
And talk about that a little bit. Why so?
Well, I gotta tell you, like, you know, I have cerebral palsy, and I'll say, like, until then, I always was very down about that and the fact that I can't do what everyone else does, and then to go to a third world country and see like how people are surviving under their situation, and it just kind of made me go, holy shit,
gave you a different perspective.
I have so much good things going on.
Uh-huh.
Palsy isn't shit compared to, you know, at least I have food, you know, I got shoes on.
Yeah.
And that's like, to me, I gotta say, that's gotta be the most pivotal point in my life, just because 15 is such an influential age, too, you know?
Yeah.
You're just kind of coming to realize your place in the world, and I feel like, to me, there couldn't have been a better experience for me.
Did you find at that point, that's when you, it sounds like a burden was lifted at that point, burden of being handicapped,
right.
Did you see humor start to surface more prominently in your perspective at that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think I always have the gift of humor. Like, I just have a mind that just goes to that. Like, it, I don't know where, you know, and like, it's a gift, you know what I mean? I don't know where the fuck that comes from. It just comes out, you know?
To define humor for me, for yourself, have you defined what is funny and why?
I've never defined it. I mean, there are so many things that are funny, and so many things that you're like, why is that funny? But I'm laughing. I think, for me, what humor is, at least on my show, is like, people have such a skewed idea of what disability is and what I should be capable of, and then the fact that I'm usually smarter than the person who's condescending me. Like, that's funny to me. It's like, I'm just having a laugh at your dumbass expense, you know? Like, you think you're being real nice to me, where I'm like, how can I take advantage of this person? You know, like, and to me, that's funny. It's like the bait and switch, you know? Like, oh, you think I'm one thing? Okay, I'll lead you down that path to let you think I'm that person. And then I'll switch it up at the end when it's the crucial point, you know?
Okay, so you went to Senegal when you were 15, you were there for a year?
Yep.
And then you...
And my mom homeschooled me, my mom and dad homeschooled me. My dad was doing a Fulbright.
Tell me a little bit about your parents. What was their background? What did they do?
So
do they do?
My mom is a librarian. Mm-hmm. And she has been. I guess she did daycare when we were younger, but then she moved to. My dad is a language professor. He retired now, but my dad is a genius. I can honestly say he's a genius. Like, he speaks 13 languages.
Oh my God.
You know, there's nothing he doesn't know or have some sort of idea about. And one thing he told me at a young age is, like, you don't need to know everything. You just need to know where to look it up. And I think that
he married the right woman, right?
Exactly. You know? And that's,
it was a match made in heaven.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So, and my family is very smart. Like, they're, it's interesting, I'm the youngest of four, and all my siblings are teachers. They all teach language, and we all speak at least three different languages. We all speak French, and then my brother speaks Korean and Spanish, and my sister speaks Italian. She's a French teacher, and her French is immaculate. Like, her accent is Parisian, you know, just, like, so good. My sister Emily, she speaks Spanish like a Mexican. She used to live in Mexico for years and taught English and Spanish there. But they, the funny thing about them is they all went to a really nice private school in St. Paul. And then because of my disability, I had to go to public school.
Oh.
So, like, I always say, I was like, my parents wanted to experiment, and like, oh, let's see what happens if we send one of these kids to a public school. Let's see what happens.
Were they disappointed or encouraged?
Well, you know, as far as career-wise, my career is pretty damn good, yeah. You know? So, and that's kind of where we differ, is, like, they are so good, like, I'm, like, the black sheep in that respect of, like, knowledge. Like, I'm not very book smart. I'm terrible at reading and writing and math. And my siblings are all superstars. But as far as street smarts, I beat the hell out of them, you know? Like, and that takes you a long way, you know? Being able to... And then again, it goes back to what my dad said. I don't need to know that as long as I know where to look it up, you know?
Well, I firmly believe that, you know, a lot of behavior is you're genetically predisposed. The way that your brain is wired up, much of that behavior, I believe, is actually, some of it's learned, but I believe a certain amount of that is genetic. And you make your living using language, and looking at your background, it sounds like, you know, your mother and your father both were really tuned in to manipulation of words and that whole world of language. So I can really see you coming out of that.
They're wordsmiths. Yeah. Like, they put the right words together where you're like, oh, wow, that's interesting. And I speak French and I speak Wolof, which is the native language of Senegal.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of people don't know, but it's,
and that was only after, well, that's just from a year of being there.
That's 1 year, and then I went back when I was 18 for 3 months, and then I went again when I was 20 for 3 more months.
What attracted you to revisit that place? And tell me just a little bit about Senegal, because I know virtually nothing about the country.
Senegal is...
You explained that it was originally a French
right,
colony.
It's a very laid-back country. My dad did a lot of teaching there, so, like, I went with him the second time, too. Like, he took a group of 7 students for independent study, and I was one of the students. The day after I graduated high school, I went to Senegal.
Oh, wow.
And I did 3 months there. And
is it poor country?
Third world. You know, it's the westernmost country in Africa.
Okay. So if we look at that hump on Africa, it's kind of that.
Right.
It's the tip of that.
Yep. And it. That's where they have the Gorée Island. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
It's the. They have the. It's the most haunting thing I've ever seen. It's the called The Door of No Return. And basically, that's where all the slaves went to board the boats. So, like, millions of slaves went through this one tiny door to get onto the boat. And I swear, like...
There was an island off the coast?
Yeah, just right off the coast. And, like, that's, like, get goosebumps now, just talking about it. Because it's, like, the most haunting, just doorway, the Door of No Return.
It's a physical port. Yep. Physical doorway. And
like
an archway.
Like, the ships would pull up...
Oh, I see.
To the door, and there'd be a plank they walked across onto the boat. So that has that kind of that culture sort of it's embedded in there, you know, and it's very, very powerful. But then Wolof is the native tongue. There's there's probably seven other languages, but Wolof is the most prominent one, and that's my favorite language to speak. Like, I love speaking that.
Can you give me a little demonstration?
Sure, like a greeting, you'd be like, Nanga Def. The answer is Mangi Thirek. And then, it's very, greetings are huge. So, like, I could, if you came here, we'd probably be still greeting. Like, I'd be like, how's your dog? How's your house? How's your family? And then we could go into our conversation and then just randomly, like, how you doing? You okay? And I feel like I've had numerous people tell me, like, I was the best non-native speaker they've ever heard. Because it's like, I kind of call myself like a chameleon, where I can go into any situation and just pick up the vibe of that thing. And like my dad, like, probably, like, grammatically speaks Wolof way better than I do. But as far as street talk, like, if there's any... we call it wahale, which means to bargain. You have to bargain for everything. You try to buy a tomato, it'll be like $5. It'll be like 2 cents. And you have to meet in the middle. And whenever there's that situation, my dad is like, go get him, boy. You know, because I make them laugh in their own language, and that goes a long way, you know? Because it's just like making fun of them. Are you crazy? I'm not paying $5 for this tomato. They're like, are you crazy? I'm not giving it for you 2 cents. You know, it's just like, it's very sing-songy. It's like fun, playful language.
So it's not just the words, it's the interaction that is important as well.
And it's very playful, like very, like,
Hey, I gotta ask you, I'm looking at this skull that's sitting on your porch ledge. What is that?
That's a cow skull.
Oh, it's just a cow. Okay.
Yeah, it got broke by some crazy homeless lady. She came and stole it off the porch and threw it.
Oh.
I have lots of bones. I have tons of skulls.
Why is that?
I don't know. the third time I went to Senegal, I did an internship in a zoo in Dakar.
Uh-huh.
And I just had access to tons of, like, crazy animal skulls. And they gave them all to me.
Oh, I see. All right.
It just kind of, like, became my thing. Seems kind of morbid and dark, but...
No, it just depends on who you are, I think. You know?
My wife hates them.
Oh. So that's why it's outside. And it's,
well, there's tons inside. Well,
so you went to... So you spent time in Senegal as a teen, and you came back... and you came back to St. Paul?
Yep.
What did you do after you returned from Africa?
The first time, or...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, just went back to being a Minnesota teenager.
Oh, okay.
Going to high school and finished that up. And, it was weird coming back from Africa and having another year, couple years of high school, you know, because I had a different perspective. And I was one of the only disabled kids in my school. Like, it was all mainstream. So I already kind of stuck out, and like I said, I had a scribe that followed me to every class, so it's definitely like, I mean, an interesting
Do you think your humor was an outgrowth of just this, a mechanism for survival, from being different?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I've had that theory before where it's really the best defense is to make people laugh, because it's really hard to look, you know, if you're going to make fun of me but I've already said something funnier than you'll ever say, you look really dumb when you say it.
Okay.
So But I feel like that was...
It's like, don't make fun of that guy because he'll make you look like a fool.
Yes, basically, yeah, you know. And I got to say, like, as far as fitting in school, I think the fact that I didn't fit the norm, but I was still able to cross all the cliques. Like, I could have sat at any lunch table, you know. I just chose the all-black girl lunch table. Because it was the most fun, and they always treated me like, this motherfucker crazy.
You know? So that was your kind of group that you hung out with in high school.
And then that's also, if there was ever anybody who picked on me, those girls would shred them. Like, verbally shred them. You know, and that's a cool thing. But I know that I could have gone up to any table and be like, hey, can I hang out with you guys? Yeah, come on, Josh, you know. And that's what's cool, is like, they knew I was funny. Like, I've always had the gift of that sort of quick. It's quick.
Yeah.
That's the thing I got.
That's something I wish I had. I always feel like I'm good when I sit down to a keyboard and I can type out thoughts that, you know, if I'm sitting across the table from somebody, I'm going, yeah, give me a couple minutes to come back with a line. I can't do it. I feel like I'm an idiot half the time when I'm talking to people. But then I go home, and an hour later, oh yeah, I should have said this.
Yeah, that's totally it. Yeah.
So maybe people are surprised when they meet me, because, man, you're not nearly as smart as I thought you was.
Exactly.
So just the opposite problem from maybe your situation. Okay. So you did you do any college work at all?
Yeah, I graduated. Like I said, I graduated from high school, went to Senegal the next day, 3 months there, and then got back, and then I went to the summer camp when I came back. That's another big influential part of my life, like
summer camp.
I got into this summer camp where, because I went to like a public school, like I got this job as like a summer job, but it was like I was the only white kid on the crew. Like, it was like kind of like a rehabilitation crew. Like, we were doing road construction and painting things. And
who went to this camp?
Well, so I got that job, and then part of the job program was like, we'll send you to this camp. And then I went to this camp, and it was like, I was like one of the only white kids at this camp, and but I just fell in love with it, and it was great. And then I became a counselor there. So I worked at that camp 4 years in a row.
Was this like in the woods somewhere? Yeah. So it was like
it's like hoods in the woods, man.
It's hoods like, in the woods.
It's like, and it's like very primitive, like no electricity, like, you know, when you're a counselor, you do 3 day canoe trips down the St. Croix River, you know, picture me in charge of 8 inner city youth, you know, and using, like, I'm canoeing, and I'm doing everything, making the fires, helping put up tents, and I think that was just a really pivotal point too, of just going, well, yeah, I do have a disability, but people listen to me, and people, you know, as much as a teenage boy will listen to you, but
which isn't very much,
right? But I also had the wits and the thing to get them to, because I knew they didn't know anything about nature, so I'd be like, okay, it's X o'clock, the bears come out now, so you probably want to get in your tent. And they'd be like, okay!
Well, I worked with a fellow who ran a very similar wilderness camp thing, but he called it Brain in Nature. And you'd go up and you'd spend 6 weeks at 9,000 feet, no electricity, no running water, and you'd study neurology.
Yeah.
But you'd also have to build your own lean-to, and you'd have to figure out how to store your food and so on and so forth. And, you know, and the kids who went were kids from juvenile hall and kids from Five Points And it was a big life-changing experience for them to, you know, and it sounds like that was a kind of a similar, you know, experience for the kids who went to that camp.
Definitely. And then, so that was, I went to Africa that summer, came back and did just 1 week at that camp. They invited me back just as, I wasn't a counselor at that point, I was just like an honorary camper. Like, they liked me a lot, so they just invited me back. It was a special week. It's week 10, the last week of the summer, and, you know, they invite only the best kids from the summer back, but I wasn't even there that summer. They just, like, yeah, we'll take you. We liked you enough from the year before to bring you again. So, that was really cool. And then, after that week, then my mom drove me from Minnesota to Washington State, where I attended the Evergreen State College.
Okay.
It's in Olympia, Washington.
Oh, yeah. Nice area.
Yeah, and it's, that's like just a wonderful school as far as alternative learning. Very, you know, liberal artsy, no grades. It's more of like, and no requirements, which is really cool. Because if you know that you suck at doing math, you don't have to do math. Instead, you can focus on what you're actually good at.
How do you know when you're done?
Well, you have certain credits. And, you know, I mean, each class has credits.
Oh, okay. But it's not...
It's not like you have to take math and science and
this.
You can just pick whatever you want to take.
I see.
And they're not traditionally taught either. Like, the first year I took one class, but it was taught by three different faculty members, like a botanist, a photographer, and a creative writer. And then they show you how all those things can be tied together.
What did you find interest in mostly?
The writing, because the professor was just a badass. Like, just a cool... Bill Ransom, he wrote a bunch of books. He co-wrote with Frank Herbert and... he's just like, just one of those badasses that, great storyteller, funny, fun, so that really drew me to that. And then photography was cool. And then after that I studied more creative writing, I dabbled in this and that, and then my junior year of college I went back to Senegal and did an independent study at a zoo. So I spent 3 months working as a zookeeper, which is totally random, but again, life-altering and life-changing. And I did something in there that I also think was a very pivotal point in my life, where I actually got them to lock me into a cage for an entire day and put myself on display.
What happened? What was that like?
I have endless stories about that. I mean, it's like, I had no shirt on, just shorts.
You got to wear shorts.
Yeah. But the thing was, is like, if you take cerebral palsy kind of out of context and put it in a cage, people think, well, what the fuck is going on? And they were, honestly, like during the afternoon, there was like 70 people around my cage, like the whole day. Feeding me peanuts and like fruit and all kinds of just stuff like that. And but I shared a wall of bars with a 400-pound gorilla.
Oh, shit.
So, like, I mean, that day, I mean...
What'd the gorilla think?
Well, it was cool because I had established a relationship with him. Uh-huh. Like, I became, I think, one of three people in the world who could pet him. And, like, just a beast, man. I mean, he's fucking huge. So strong and just amazingly cool. But so we shared a wall of bars, and then basically it was his other half of his cage.
Yeah.
So how you clean the cage is you slide the door over, and you'll go in there, you put food in there.
Right.
And you slide it shut, go clean that side.
Got it.
So I was on this side. And what happened was... they have like a 3-hour siesta at the zoo where they just shut it down. Yeah. And they're like, you want to get out? And I was like, no, I'm gonna do the whole day in here. And everybody leaves, and I'm in
everyone left the zoo.
Yeah, I mean, there's no visitors, and all the zookeepers are eating lunch or
right.
taking a little nap or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting in the little concrete shelter area.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I hear the very distinct sound of metal bending. I was like, what the fuck? And I, like, look out, and the gorilla has, like, wrapped his fingers around that metal door and is, like, prying it back to get into me. And I'm like, oh my God, people aren't going to, by the time they get here, I'll be long dead. Like, and it wasn't like, I don't think he wanted to kill me, I think he just wanted to play.
Right.
So then I just was like, alright, I guess it's time to play. So like for 2 hours, I just ran back and forth along the bars and like tickled him and fed him.
To distract him from bending the bars anymore,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It wasn't the bars, it was actually just the metal door slides over, you know?
But so he could have come in.
I think if I had let him do it longer, he probably would have eventually. Because, I mean, it was like, I heard the noise. I was like, oh my God. And then, it was just such a funny, I should let you read the story. I wrote it one time, I wrote it in college. It's one of those stories that is just so ridiculous. Because it's, like, they started calling me the boo-boo monkey. Like, the zookeepers were calling me that. And then there was one zookeeper that came up front, and I always thought he didn't like me. Because he chased me one time with, like, a hedge clippers. And he was up front and center. And I've been studying, like, primate behavior the whole time, so I kind of knew how they acted. And, like, if a primate doesn't want to talk to you or pay attention to you, it'll give you the coldest shoulder you've ever had. So I was like, I didn't speak at all during the time in there. And I remember there was like 70 people, and this zookeeper I thought didn't like me, he was like pretending like he was the foremost expert on the boo-boo monkey. He's like, yes, from the mountains of Congo.
Oh,
and
God.
We captured him, you know, and like, and I'm just sitting there, because it's all in French and Wolof. And, like, I don't think the audience think I understood, you know, Wolof. And I could hear people's conversations in Wolof about me.
Oh.
And I'm just, like, I'm trying not to laugh. Because they're like, what is that? Like, what is that? And then there was, like, one point where, there was a woman who was, she spoke some English, and she was like, I know you understand me. And I just kept like, And then, I think that's who it was. She, what?
Somebody you know?
Yeah. She finally said in English, I think she spoke English, and she didn't speak well. She goes, you're crazy. And in Wolof, I said back, Yamagana Dof, which means you're crazier than I am. And everybody laughed. Like, except for her, because she didn't speak Wolof. And they're like, she's like, what did he say? What did he say? And some, like, English student goes, he said, you are crazier than he is. And it was just a good laugh. Let's see what we got here.
You need some help bring some stuff in?
Hey. How's it going? Oh, thank you.
That's such a great story.
And it was, I mean, it was endless. I mean, so many things that day. Like, I actually, earlier in my trip, I got malaria. And I had to go to the hospital and get a shot.
Yeah.
And, the doctor, I forget where he was from, somewhere in the Middle East. And I told him, well, you should bring your kids to the zoo for a visit. And of course, that's the day he came. And he sees me, like, in a cage. And he gave me the craziest look, like, oh my God, the shot didn't fix you, or something like that. He's like, do you remember me? And I was like, and I, like, symboled, like, shot in the butt. Like,
you made the hand sign.
Yeah.
Injection. But, yeah. That's so funny.
But then I also remember, like,
how old were you when this 18?
I was 19.
19?
No, I was probably 20.
Okay.
20. And then, to be honest with you, that was a point in my life where I go, now I can die. Like, if I died now, I could say that I've accomplished and done something that probably no one else has ever done. And that was also just kind of like, you ever just let yourself go and surrender to, like, your existence?
On occasion, yeah,
it's an
sure.
interesting, like, feel where you're like, okay, I've
done it. What if my life ended yesterday?
Yeah.
Where would I be now?
Right.
So that was kind of one of those moments for you.
Mm-hmm.
That you just kind of said, okay, anything goes from this point on.
Yep.
Right?
Uh-huh.
All right. So so you went back and you finished college in Washington.
Uh-huh.
And so what led you to stage comedy?
Well, that was it. My somewhere in there,
how old are you now? If
I'm
you don't mind me asking.
32. I'll be 33 November 27th.
Okay.
Somewhere in there, I tried stand-up comedy at college. It was like an open mic night for music and poetry, and then my friends were always just like, you're so funny, you need to go on stage and just try it. And I was so nervous, like the worst stage fright ever. But I was like, you guys, just make me do it. Like, you gotta make me get up there. And they did, and it was really cool phenomenon that happened. Was like, usually there was like maybe 20 people at the open mic night. And I went up and did 10 minutes and just storytelling and stuff like that. Talk about Africa as a kid and things like that. And then I told the audience I'd be back to do it again the next week. And through word of mouth, like, the next week I went there was, like, 70 people there. And, like, I know they were there for me because when I was done, they all left.
Oh.
And I was like, wow, there's something happening here. Like,
uh-huh.
This is something. And then I did it a couple more times with big groups of people. And then one time I did it, and I felt like I just bombed. Like, it was the worst feeling you'll ever get is bombing on stage. And I didn't do it again for a while, but it was just in my head, and I was like, I gotta do that again.
Because you had the earlier success, and
right.
Maybe you looked at the bomb as just a fluke, or something you wanted to figure out why it didn't work.
Right, yeah.
Did you figure out why it didn't work that one time?
No, and the thing is, other people were like, oh, that was funny, that was fun. Like, but to me, it was like, something wasn't right about it. But then I did it, and then at the college I went to, I got into theater, did a big play. Again, it's like one class taught by a couple different teachers. So, like, we learn how to make the stage, we learn how to stage design, we learn how to act, we learn how to all this. And it was really cool. And then we got a chance to do our own project. And then I just was like, well, I want to do stand-up. But what I did was I had actors where I would start telling a story stand-up style. And then as the story went on, then the actors would come in and I would, like, leave the stand-up behind. And it would go into, like, an act. Or
like a skit.
Yeah, like a skit. And then I would just go back to stand-up pose and then set up the next one. And then... And that was, like, people loved that. And people were like, wow, that's really cool. So then I had one more semester of college, and then I was like, I want to study stand-up. And then that's what I did my last quarter. I actually created a curriculum to study stand-up, and then I found a faculty member who would support it. And it doesn't mean they know anything about stand-up, but they just saw what I wanted to do, and they made sure I did what I said I was going to do. And then that was really cool in the fact that I set these goals of what I was going to do, and then I was actually able to...
Well, what was that process exactly? Can you describe that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, how I describe it is I basically watched Richard Pryor tapes and got high, but but there was more to it than that. But, I mean, watch...
My thesis, the effects of marijuana and LSD on the perception of humorous material. Yeah.
But it was like, there's a difference when you watch comedy and enjoy it, and then when you watch comedy and you watch, like, how did he stand when he delivered that joke? How did he set this up? How did he, you know, like Richard Pryor, you know?
So you're very analytical.
Right.
Very left brain, logical.
Right, like, how does he go from a setup to the punchline?
Yeah.
And it's like, with Pryor, he's very storyteller.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I was back then. Now I got jokes, you know, like... And basically a joke is just a story that you take all the extraneous words out of and just keep it as bare bones as possible. And then what I said was I was going to do a show a week and just... perform as much as I could, and then hopefully get on stage at a real comedy club. And then what happened was I found a band that was performing at a coffee shop. They would do two bands, and then the headlining band that had the gig said I could do like the 15 minutes between the two bands.
Sure.
And very rapidly we realized that, like, the coffee shop would be full for the first band, and then me, and then everybody would leave. And it was, like, that happened 2 weeks in a row, and I felt so bad, because it was a band that asked me to be there, but then everyone would just leave, and it'd be, like, two people, like...
Oh, no.
So then the coffee shop owner was like, you need your own night.
Uh-huh.
And then they gave me my own show every week, and I did an hour show every week of new material. I can't do that now.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a professional. I could not do that now.
Is that right?
But I was just going up there and going...
Well, why was it that you could do... It was just that you had the time for preparation and...
Not even. I've never written anything down. I've never written any of this...
Oh, you've never written anything down. So
no.
You're all working in your head.
Yeah.
Oh.
So what I was...
I have nightmares about that. Going, being on stage and forgetting my lines.
Right. Well, here's
like, that's like walking on the wing of an airplane.
Here's my theory is if you don't write it down, you can't mess it up. Because there's nothing prepared. You know if you mess something up that was written down. If it's not written down, how can you mess it up? There's nothing there to mess up.
Well, how would you prepare for that? I mean, would you just,
I would just
at home and
I would go through and go, okay, I want to tell the story from that camp that I worked at.
Yeah.
One particular time about, you know, I think one of the stories was about me, like, you know, picture me telling an inner city girl that I'm your counselor. And the girl's looking at me like, you want me to get in a boat with that man? Like, you know, just like things like that. I would tell stories from Africa. I would tell stories... from the zoo,
So if someone walked into your home, would they hear you talking out loud to like a blank wall?
No,
or would
I've
you
never
be doing it silently inside your... I'm just curious.
No,
silently inside your head.
I never even go really through the words or the thing. I just go, this is what I'm going to talk about.
You just kind of reminisce about the situations.
Yeah. And then I just...
Well, that's incredible.
It's a weird gift that I have that I can go up and go... I finally come, like, just now I'm finally getting comfortable with the fact that I feel like I can be given any topic and make it funny. Like, I don't know how it works, but I have enough faith in my gift now where I'm like, wow, I can talk about 9/11 and probably make it funny, you know? Like, it's a hard subject, but,
Well, I mean, to me, that's, it's extraordinary. For me, a metaphor is, I'm a musician also,
uh-huh.
It would be as though I would show up for a gig not having any sheet music and then improvising for an hour and having people sit and enjoy it. I mean, that would be... Cecil Taylor used to do that kind of thing, but he just ended up with a bunch of noise as far as I was concerned. So that's a... That sounds like such an extraordinary...
How's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Not only ability, but also reflective of just this enormous amount of self confidence and self-knowledge
right.
that you know, yeah, I can do that and feel safe doing that.
Well, I look at it as just a story from my life that I'm just telling again, you know? And I don't know, it's just the uncanny gift of, like, always saying the funny thing. Whereas, like I laugh because I've never thought of it before. It just comes out when I'm on the spot.
Now, what led, now you were involved in the last Comic Standing, mm-hmm. right? And then you won that. Tell me a little bit about what led to that experience and what that was like.
Well, I mean, I moved to Denver after graduating, just on a whim.
I was going to say, why Denver?
My good friend Liz Kober, she grew up here. Her dad runs an organization called Shalom Denver.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's a organization that only hires disabled people to do, like, mass shippings, like stuff envelopes.
Or right.
Do that sort of stuff, which is cool. I mean, it's a task that people, you don't need to be a rocket science, it's just to stuff an envelope. You know?
It's a job, right.
And she told me she could get me a job as, like, a counselor to take care of.
Oh, okay.
Sort of like a boss. And then I ended up working at an organization called Support Inc., which is basically a daycare for adults with, you know, developmental disabilities and physical disabilities. And I got that job, and that was one of those things where it was like, it's such a worthy job, like, those people really need my help. But every single day I was doing that job, I was, like, miserable, going, there's got to be more to my life than this.
Right.
There's more than this.
Now, that's key to me, because you're tuning in now to this reward-punishment mechanism within the brain, which, if you're doing something that is detrimental to your health and survival, your brain gives you negative feedback. It gives you distress and pain.
Right.
And it sounds like, okay, your brain is now signaling that this is not the end of the road. This is not the right path.
This is not me.
Right.
And, like, every single day, there's one coworker. I remember, it's kind of a funny thing, where I had a house on 13th and Delaware,
mm-hmm.
over on the Bail Bond Row area, Golden Triangle.
Yeah.
And basically, it used to be an art gallery for the Shalom Denver, but they couldn't run it anymore, so they gave it to me, and rent was...
Oh, over by the art museum.
Yeah. Rent was $375 a month.
Uh-huh.
And there was, like, three of us living there. So I was like, I made, like, $10.50 an hour at this place, but that was... I only had to pay $125 rent, so I just kept saving my money. And I remember there was, like, that coworker that was there, and very sarcastic older guy. We would, mess with each other. He always busted my balls because I would always pick up pennies. I was like, man, I had this money. And, like, he got to the point where he'd bring in a pocket of pennies, and he'd just throw them on the floor and watch me pick them up. I'm like, man, this is money. I don't care. I got enough for a beer tonight, you know? And, like, it was one of those things where it's just like, I would, like, scheme with him. Like, I was in my head going, I was like, man, I can't do this job. I'm like, what do you want to run scams on the elderly? You want to, like, what should we do? I think I could, because I knew, like, I have this gift of, like, being very charming. Like, I can talk to anybody. And I was like, definitely leaning toward using my ability for evil as opposed to good. And then I found the comedy scene in Denver. And then I jumped on that.
There's a comedy works down at Larimer Square at the time, or?
Yep. So that's the first time I saw the club. I walked by there. And this is a really, I have this in my book, actually, but I was looking at the marquee of who was coming, and then a couple walked by, and I had no idea who they were just looking at the same marquee. And I looked at them and I go, one day my face is going to be on this marquee. And then they looked at me and they just go, we believe you. And it was like weird. It was like they don't know me. I know I probably look crazy and homeless, but like the way they said, we believe you, they believe me. Like, because the way I said it, you know? Uh-huh. And it was like, from there on, I was just like, all right, let's figure this out.
Uh-huh.
And then I found some open mic nights at bars around town that had like, you know, winner gets $35.
Uh-huh.
And the first time I went, I got second place.
Uh-huh.
And everyone was like, you should have won. Like,
oh.
And it was like that. And then I kept going back and to different places, and people were like, who the hell is this kid, like, coming up? And then someone told me how to get on at Comedy Works. And I went there, and, you know, they give you 2 minutes your first time, and
yeah.
I killed it. Yeah. And then you get 5 minutes the next time. And then I ran into a glitch with one of the workers there. He was the guy that booked the new talent night, and he didn't like me because he saw I was really good, and he was a comic. And there's like a lot of
competition.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would say comedians shouldn't book like new talent because they're too jaded with their own careers.
Yeah.
And then we actually got into like almost a physical altercation. Where he like got in my face and was like, you'll never succeed in this business, you're too like he used like a disability, like no social skills. I was like fuck you, dude, I got hundreds more friends than you do. Like, but then like the club, one of the managers of the club saw that guy get in my face, and she went to bat for me.
Uh-huh.
He got fired.
Oh.
And then I got promoted to like actually getting paid to work there.
Oh.
And it was a very rapid, like, what happened was there was a contest. They have a new talent contest every year. And the first time I went, I just won the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
$500 in my pocket.
Wow.
And, you know, like I said, that's 4 months rent for me.
Right.
You know, I was like, sweet. Now I'm
doing the right thing.
So, yeah, and I had the nest egg building from that other job, and I quit that.
Uh-huh.
As soon as I won that thing, I was like, I can survive now.
Okay.
I got, you know, I could survive this rent for 2 years, you know? And now I just did odd jobs, kind of like being the shark, coming into these little contests and taking all the money, you know? And
so did you start traveling around to clubs in Colorado or out of state yet?
Not yet. That's when I found my manager, who represents me now, Mike Raftery.
Mm-hmm.
He works through Comedy Works. His company is Comedy Works Entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of funny. I actually I was like, do you remember the first time we met? And he goes, yeah, you cocky little fuck. You walked into my office and threw a tape on my desk and go, you might want to watch this.
You might want to watch this.
And I go, did you? He goes, no.
Oh, it was a videotape. Yeah, that was the joke. I was going to say, you threw an audio cassette, you ought to watch this. I thought you made a joke.
No, it was like a videotape.
Oh, okay.
And he's like, no. And
oh,
then,
it did?
And then the word of mouth started going around and it got back to him that I was...
I can't believe he didn't even bother to look at the thing.
He probably did later, but
he didn't want to admit it.
He just, you know, that's our relationship. No. Why would I watch that shit, you know? From there, he took a meeting with me, and I was like, I see your potential, but you don't even barely have a 10-minute set. I can't really book you on too much just because you're not gonna, you know. But then, like, 2 months later, he's like, okay, you're ready.
Oh,
and
I see.
He started booking me to go on the road, like, one-nighters in Wyoming and
uh-huh.
things like that. So, and then I made the list at Comedy Works, which was basically making the list at Comedy Works is you're a made man. Like, you're... Comedy Works is different in the way they book their shows. They'll have a national touring headliner
yes.
come in.
Yeah.
Most clubs, most clubs will have a touring feature act, but they never bring the feature acts. They just pull from the wealth of comics they have here in Denver.
Comedy Works does that.
Yeah. So
they have national people come in, right?
The headliners.
Oh, okay.
But like the people go on before.
Oh, them, I see. And that's different from other comedy.
Other comedy clubs will bring in a feature. Usually a feature will do 30 minutes in front of the headliner, who will do 45 to an hour.
Oh, but Comedy Works has like a pool of local talent,
right,
that they use as the first part of the night.
Right. So then once you get in that pool, that's like you're a made man.
It's like you've got a job.
Right. And then, it pays you, what, $20 a set or whatever.
No.
But I was opening for like Chappelle and Carlos Mencia, Brian Regan, Jake Johansson, like all these comedy superstars, you know? And it's like what an opportunity for a young comic to get to like go and do that. And then I didn't have that other day job anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So even when I wasn't on the show, they let me come and just hang out.
Mm-hmm.
So I would watch comedy like...
So it was more schooling.
5 nights a week, where I would just go and... And even if I had seen the same show the night before, I would come again just so that I could see how the headliner switched their act,
mm-hmm,
up and saw. And what I learned is what I like about comedy, and what I learned is what I don't like about comedy. And I think that's, like, when you see how a headliner conducts themselves, like, I always use Brian Regan as an example. Whenever someone comes in the room, even if it's like the door guy, they'll stand up and shake their hand. Oh, nice to meet you. And some comics are just such arrogant pricks.
You mean from the stage? Or
from
the back of the room?
Yeah, like when he's, if before the show. Like,
oh,
he's
okay
in the dressing room.
So they're interacting just on a personable level, like,
right,
any normal person,
right,
might, right?
Right. And
or even above that, making an effort to be personable.
And I learned that, like comedy, like the waitresses at Comedy Works, they have a lot of power. And a lot of times young comics don't realize that. Like, if you're polite, you stay out of their way, and you tip well, they're gonna go, hey, that guy's really fun, and that guy's nice. And obviously you have to have some talent too, but it's like, it's not, being funny is not just one, I mean, it's not just the thing. There's so many other factors to the whole machine. And that's what I was learning, is like, how do I conduct myself offstage so these people will talk to me to their boss? And basically, that's what happened. They took it back to Wendy Curtis, who's the owner, and basically told her that I was the real deal.
So you saw this ability to interact on a social level was made for a better comic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty, from a behavioral standpoint, and I'm speaking of, neurophysiology, that's very important to me, because I find that to be a thread that runs throughout all careers. When you're, that you involve yourself on a personal level with exactly as you described it, it's to your great advantage at the professional level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So very interesting that, you make that very conscious observation
there. Right. And to me, like, interacting in a nice, friendly way is just how I conduct myself.
Yeah.
But also then going, oh, this is beneficial as well.
Yeah.
And realizing that, that's when it kind of gelled, Like, oh, okay.
Well, it's to compare it with lions hunting in a pride. One lion goes out by himself. He's not nearly as successful as if he's got all his friends with him.
Right.
And everyone has their own role to play, mm-hmm, in that hunt. But it's this cooperative mindset,
mm-hmm,
and it proves more successful. And so, yeah, you demonstrated that, very, very well.
It was a cool feeling.
Yeah.
And then, obviously, from there, Last Comic Standing is you know, whenever that is going to air, everybody, the comic community knows that's a big deal.
Did they come to Denver for auditions? Is that
they
how that
not,
worked?
They did not.
So you had to go out of town for
I
an
went
audition?
To Chicago. I auditioned twice, actually.
Okay.
The first year I was in Chicago. I waited in line for probably 6 hours. And I remember they had one of those clock thermometers on one of the buildings.
Uh-huh.
It was negative 15.
Oh, shit.
And we were standing in line for 6 hours.
Oh, my God.
You know, you're just
that's
like
insane.
Jumping around.
That's
trying
just
to stay
insane.
Alive.
This is outside?
That's just a line.
That's ridiculous.
So then they finally like start taking people in. And I barely thought out by the time it was my turn to go on.
Yeah.
And it's the most terrifying thing. You go on there, there's two guys in the audience, and then like five cameras. You know, comedy is a very give and take thing. Like, if two guys are in the audience, even if they laugh their hardest, it's still like, now what, you know? But I only did like a minute, and they were like, thank you, next.
Oh.
And I was like, you know, pretty hurt. Like, just, okay, this is just a stupid reality show. They're not looking for talent. They're looking for a show. And then as I walked out, I said something that actually made them laugh. I go, this was a shitty make-a-wish. And they laughed at that. And then the next year it came around, and I was very, like, devastated and just kind of jaded toward that show just because I was like, they're not looking for...
It's just a commercial enterprise for NBC to sell deodorant, right?
Exactly. And then my manager, Mike, was like, okay, man, obviously it wasn't good, but you gotta try again, man. You gotta go back again. And they actually got me an audition this time where I didn't have to stand in line.
Oh, okay.
So I actually got to, like, have a set time. And that's where you learn it's just a setup show, because all those people in line outside, they're never gonna pick any of those people. They only really pick professional comics, you know. Cause so the year that I didn't get it, then I had like 35 college gigs in between there.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I didn't get it the first time, because then I had so much more experience.
You're much better.
So much more material.
So it was taking that net. You know, it was like, you know, getting over the hump of that negative experience, but you had enough drive. And
my thing was,
that's very revealing to me in terms of what you're saying about that show.
Right.
And what occurred to me immediately was all these other shows like American Idol and all, how much of those are set up in the same way, that it's bullshit, that they're, you know, that...
But then they...
Actually, and I don't know.
And then they draw from actual talent.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was cool that, you know, I was considered actual talent and they got me my spot. And then once I got on there, I just went in with the attitude that this is my mind to win.
Yeah.
And I... If you
so you're visualizing that success in your head,
right? I can. And another thing is, like, there's challenges through the whole show where, you know, you get to pick out another comic to challenge or whatever.
Yeah.
Nobody ever challenged me. They were scared of me, man. They're like, we are not fucking with that guy, and that was it. Like I went to win, and I did. And
how many? What was that? Now, see, I'm not familiar with that show, so forgive me. But how long was that process from that initial audition to the final show, where you're, you know, selected as the winner of the series?
I was on 13 episodes.
Oh my God, it's a long haul.
And the thing is, it wasn't. I didn't even realize this till just recently, but it wasn't even supposed to be that long. But we had such good ratings that they extended the show. I didn't even realize that.
No kidding.
But, I mean, it's weird. It's a weird thing to, like, realize is, like, that was me. Like, everyone on the show, we were a great cast and everything, but, like, I won that show by, like, millions of votes. And, like...
It's like the call-in votes from,
yeah,
from the public.
The first few episodes is, like, you get disqualified through challenges that doesn't involve the public, but then, like, the last 4 or 5 episodes, America calls in and votes.
I see.
And, like...
Now, are you paid while you're doing this?
Yeah.
So you're making a salary as you're going up in the ranks?
Uh-huh.
And there's, like, a grand prize or something?
And then I also got to go and do shows. You know, we'd film, like, once a week, and then
uh-huh.
I'd go fly to San Francisco, do shows there. So.
Yeah, so, okay, so you're selected as the winner of that season. How did your life change from that point? And how, maybe, did this internal... stuff change after you won that, or how didn't it change?
Well, I feel like I was very fortunate in the fact that I had the presence of mind to know that my life was going to change.
Uh-huh.
And kind of, and my management too, like, they were very, on top of it. Like, what we did was we went into it like I was going to win, and we set up the right steps so that when I did win, we weren't going, oh God, we gotta figure this out, gotta figure this out.
Uh-huh.
We actually took a meeting with the guy who won the year before.
Oh.
What do we need to know? What would you wish you knew? He's like, tell us, get a business planner, get a publicist,
uh-huh.
get this and that. And we had all those things in place by the time I won.
So
it was just like a smooth step. Like, all right, I won, now let's take advantage of this shit.
Yeah, sure, that's very interesting.
And it was a really cool...
I would expect that had an influence on your performance as well, because you're sort of like channeling yourself,
right.
And you're putting yourself in something that comes up frequently when I'm talking to people is that they say, well, I act as just what you said. I act as though I already had it.
Right.
I'm in that place. Even though I'm not in that place, I put myself as if I already had what I'm going after, and that's where I'm operating from.
Right.
And that changes how you operate and is much more conducive to, you know, succeeding.
Success. Yeah, I mean...
So, what's your... So, these days, what is your... You know, what's your life like in terms of, you know, your career and you know, tell me a little bit about how that affects your family life and your values and what's important.
Sure, and then I guess I should say one other crazy thing that's going on throughout all that is basically I also tried out for the National Paralympic Soccer Team. Basically at the same time I left that other job.
Uh-huh.
And I got on the team, and, like, I've been to 8 countries playing soccer.
So you're playing soccer professionally?
I was in the 2004 Olympics in Athens, Greece, and my team just qualified for London next summer.
So you have a dual life here.
And if you put it in perspective, like, that's just kind of weird. It's like, most people dream, not most people, but, like, athletes dream of reaching the level that I've made it to, and like that's the back burner for me. Like
uh-huh.
that's secondary to my comedy career. And when you put that in perspective, you're like, wow, that's insane. Like I travel and I get to be an Olympic athlete, and it's one of those things where I have so many things on my plate where it's like, oh my God, like how do I stay in shape while I tour and drink beer all night, and yeah. But it's just the will. I think it's just the whatever is in my head. It's like I will not be deterred. I will not be denied. Like when I play soccer, I'm not the most fit guy on the field, but I know how to kick a ball hard, and I know how to kick a ball where it needs to go. It doesn't. I don't necessarily need to run faster than the other person. It's just about where you put the ball,
right?
And that's pretty cool. Like it's a cool, cool experience. Now, all these things that I do his coming back to not fight me, but it's definitely, I'm a family man now. I got two kids and a wife, and I own this house, and we live in the back house.
Uh-huh.
There's four apartments.
Oh, this is the apartment, and then you live in the carriage house?
There's four apartments in here.
Uh-huh.
So I'm a slumlord.
So you get some income from this?
Yeah, it helps pay the mortgage.
This is like one of the old Denver, I don't know, it's like a castle in a sense, but it's this is concrete that's made to look like...
No, that's all rock.
This is actual, like, it looks like it's granite.
I forget what it's called. Like
some sort of quarried stone.
Yeah, and you see other houses like this.
Yeah, the Molly Brown house is constructed in the same manner.
It's the same architect.
Oh.
Any of these type rock houses is the same architect.
Is that right in Denver?
Yeah.
Kind of reddish, it's like a reddish.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. It must be granite or sandstone, perhaps. I bet it's sandstone, huh?
It was built in 1896.
1896.
Well, there's four apartments in here.
Yeah.
And they're all musicians.
Oh.
Different bands.
Uh-huh.
But when they all come together, it's my house band.
Oh.
It's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, big-time band. Like, you know, touring country.
Right.
Like, Nathaniel Rateliff, one of the members of that band. Just a bunch of local Denver awesome musicians, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's cool. I've surrounded myself with music that I love and never really able to... I can't play an instrument, but I'm able to... Like, I have the feel. I got the African beat in me, man, and I love it. And it's cool. And it's cool to know that when I go on the road, there's a bunch of people here who are good friends that can help my wife if something happens, or
So what do you see in your changes that you see in your future it sounds like book, you know, you mentioned the book writing, it sounds like that's something you kind of want to get into.
That stems from college when I did a bunch of creative writing and stuff like that, and you know, I wrote that story about being in the zoo when I was in college, and that kind of just made me go, oh, I need to, because my life is every day is some random shit happens where it's like, man, does that happen to other people? I don't think so. And I guess it's kind of like I said when I was in that cage surrendering to the world, like, all right, now I can go.
Well, that's such a unique experience. I've never heard of anyone doing that. I haven't gone through that. That's such a great thing.
I'm trying to set it up at the zoo here.
Oh!
To do a redo it.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm in with the zoo. I do some shows for them. And I'm obviously a big zoo advocate just because I did that experience over there. And they take me under the wing over there, let me feed the elephants and the hippos and stuff like that. So I'm trying to redo it. Maybe as a promotional for the zoo. And then also, I could do some amazing headshots with that.
Well, let me ask you if you're aware of, if you've ever given much thought to the actual processes, more in the direction of the work that I do, the processes of feedback inside your own head and inside your brain. Are you ever aware of, specific things going on inside your brain and processes, and have you ever given much thought to, one side of your brain talk to another side, or what's this feeling inside my head or anything like that?
Well, there's a couple things on that. One, I'm coming to realize that because of my disability, I've had to learn alternative routes to get to an end product that aren't the normal ways of getting there, like writing a book.
Okay.
Using someone else to dictate. That's not a normal process. And I think that's kind of why I am able to be as successful as I am, because I don't see things the same way everybody else does. And I go, oh, if I take that path, you didn't see that big tree there. Instead, I'll go this way. It may take longer, but I'll get there without having to deal with whatever that roadblock is. That's one thing. And then as far as, feedback and, I feel like I'm just kind of now... How do you say it? Like, embracing myself or what effect I have on people. Like when you see my show, you're gonna get a good hard laugh, but you're also gonna leave with a different perspective of disability and the disabled community. And I've always gotten feedback from people in ways that like were almost too heavy to like take and hold and go, oh wow, I really affected that person. But now I'm getting to a point where like, wow, there is more to what I'm doing than just comedy. Like, I don't know how many times, at least once a show, someone will come up and go, hey, my dad died of cancer, but he watched you and we had a laugh together. And then you're like, holy shit, like that's real, that's heavy, you know? And then I also think everybody, my personal opinion, everybody has a disability in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, everyone can relate to it, you know?
Some are physical, some are
mental.
Hidden.
Yeah.
Silent.
Yeah, and
everyone's got there.
That's it. Yeah, I hate to say this. I got another meeting.
All right.
6 minutes.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you.
But he'll be here.
Oh, okay.
So we're fine.
All right.
We're fine.
One of the things I touch, the primary thing that I'm touching upon in this book is this conscious exercise in which one tickles a part of one's brain. The book's called Tickle Your Amygdala. And you have these two little buttons. Do you know what the amygdala is?
Mm-mm.
In the midbrain,
okay.
Halfway between the primitive reptile brain core,
mm-hmm.
which regulates autonomic nervous functions, like heart rate, breathing. Okay, so you got this reptile brain core in the back,
mm-hmm.
lower part of your brain. Then you got your frontal lobes,
mm-hmm.
which is the most advanced part of your brain. And that's where imagination, planning, logic,
mm-hmm.
concepts of time, and humor, as it turns out. These are all outgrowths of this advanced frontal lobe. You have this little switch that's right halfway in between.
Mm-hmm.
And when you perceive a threat, you see a snake in the path,
mm-hmm.
the switch clicks back and it turns up the reptile brain.
Right.
So you get fight or flight.
Right?
Right? Mm-hmm. But it's a reaction. You don't
mm-hmm.
think.
Right.
You become instantly stupid.
Mm-hmm.
But you can run away fast.
Right.
Right? Or you can fight good. On the other hand, when this switch is clicked forward and the energy is able to go more into this frontal lobe...
Oh, it's just a snake.
That's
be fine.
Well, well, the idea is when you're able to get the switch to go forward, then you can calculate, you can be more human, and you can be funny. Humor is calculated in this frontal lobe's part of the brain. So, in essence, in order to understand comedy... to have a sense of humor, to use your imagination, you have to tickle this amygdala so you get the energy going in that front part of your brain so you can understand things at a higher level,
right.
above just fight or flight.
Sure.
And for many years, the fellow that I studied with used to call it clicking your amygdala.
Mm-hmm.
You could click it backwards into reptile brain,
mm-hmm.
fight or flight, or you could click it forwards and turn on, humor and planning and all the fun stuff. And your brain associates negative emotions with being clicked backwards, but positive emotions, like laughter
mm-hmm.
and appreciation and love, with the front part of your brain. And it dawned on me when I first started writing my own books that it would be better to call it tickling your amygdala
mm-hmm.
because it then integrates this idea of pleasure and positive reinforcement as opposed to,
mm-hmm.
People knew that tickling the amygdala turned on the goody spot of their brain.
Right.
And
well, I wonder what that is for me, because I feel like I definitely like emergencies, I remain calm and,
uh-huh.
and like think logically about the situation.
Yeah.
And I also feel like people ask me what about like comedy for me is like I just have a really good imagination.
Yeah.
Like I can imagine something and then say it and make you believe whatever it is I'm making up.
Well, they're linked. See, imagination and this positive emotion, they go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. And what people don't realize that they can directly and consciously direct their consciousness to go forward. And you put it well. You said, you know, I stay calm in emergency situations. And you have this natural, you have this natural ability to tickle that amygdala and stay forward, whereas some people in that same situation, all they would know how to do is panic.
Well, to me, I wonder what, like, because, you know, cerebral palsy is a type of a brain injury. I wonder if something messed up the switch where it doesn't switch back as rapidly as it would.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
The wiring of your brain. Is this your friend?
Like, God.
All right.
Sorry.
Well, no. Thank you, Josh. That was really fun and interesting. And I'll look forward to seeing you at the coffee shop again.
Yeah, and again, if you have more questions, we can do more another time.
Well, that's great. And I'll make sure. And so thank you very much. I really appreciate the time you spent with me.